Hello, everybody. I'm Lex.
I'm Britt.
And this is Stark Raving Madness. Today, the lovely Britt, Tit. Today the lovely Britt, Tit, is going to be introducing me to a case.
Indubitably.
That I know the name, but I don't know anything about this person.
Indubitably.
So... That brings us to our weekly schedule that we have came up for you guys.
Yeah, we got some organization in this
bitch. Woohoo! Now. So, Monday, I'm going to do an episode. And on Wednesday, we're both going to do an episode. And then on Friday, Britt is going to do an episode. And hopefully Friday, we'll have some better recording equipment.
Yeah, hopefully.
Hopefully. Fingers crossed for that. So... Let's take a deep dive in to whatever Britt has for us today.
Oakley to Oakley. Neighborly neighbor.
Howdy, neighbor.
So, today we're going to talk about Aaron Swartz. And if you don't know who Aaron Swartz is, he was an activist and a... I guess you could say a creator. He created things online that are very important to us now. Well, not a lot of people know about him. So Aaron Swartz was born on November 8th, 1986. And if you guys haven't heard about him or seen the documentary, you guys should check out his documentary for sure after this or even right now. I don't even care.
Yeah, just drop us and go watch his documentary.
Yeah, just forget about it. Fuck us. Go watch this documentary. So anyway, it's called.
I wouldn't even be mad if you did.
But it's that good. I've watched it like 3 or 4 times already. It's called The Internet's Own Boy, and you can find it on YouTube for free. Actually, as far as I've checked, it's still on there. But you're going to want to go check that out because it'll go deeper into this story than what I'm able to in, like, 45 minutes. So, anyway, he was born on November 8th, 1986, and he was born in Highland Park, Illinois. And this dude is a pretty phenomenal guy, like... Out of anybody that we've talked about on this podcast, he's somebody that I could say that you can look up to without regretting it.
You know? Look up to Albert Fish, I'm going to kind of question you.
Yeah, just, no, you need therapy if you're going to look up to Albert Fish.
You're looking up to Albert Fish. Like, man, pot roast out of a child.
Right? No.
Speaking of that, my mom was like, I'm going to make pot roast for dinner tomorrow. And I was like, Mom, I can't, in good consciousness, without wanting to throw up, eat. Anymore, and she was like, "Why?" And I was like, "Because of Albert Fish." And she was like, "Well, he just made the butt out of the pot roast." And I was like, "That's even worse." Like now I'm thinking about a child's butt while eating this pot roast, and I don't want that. Like I'm gonna be so grossed out because I had to research. You got a little bit lucky with that one.
You had to describe to our listeners
what that man did for his kids.
Yeah.
So like, I'm screwed.
You're right. Granted, I did watch the History Channel shit, so I do know what he did.
Right, he was very fucked up, dude.
But anyway, not somebody you should look up to.
Though, real quick, before you start, I did look up if that was still free on YouTube, and it is.
Oh, okay.
So you guys can
Drop a link to that then after all this is done with. So anyway, he was born in Highland Park, Illinois, and he was a really sweet dude. He was very laid back. He was really, really, really smart. Like, I can't put into words how stupidly smart this kid is. Like, basically, he must only seem like a prodigy type.
Gotcha. Okay, cool.
And so, he had two brothers, Noah and Ben, and from what I saw, they all were kind of close-knit best friends during basically their entire life.
Right.
Like, even when Aaron was gaining success, he still shared, like, his success with his brothers.
Okay, so he didn't become into, like, a giant douche.
No, no. He was very much so, like, against people that were like that. He was honestly probably one of the most humble people that I've heard of existing.
So you don't find
people that are like that. Now, he was very, very cocky as a person just because, like, he knew he was smart. So he thought that people could be better than what they were. But that was the only, like,
so, like, negative.
He came across as that when he was, you know, trying to help people out.
I got you.
Or debating with people, you know.
Yeah,
but that's what happens, though, when you
got big brains.
When you got big brains, you know you got big brains. So
big brain madness, something that we're lacking around here, right?
Right, Rick? Yeah. So anyway, when his brothers and stuff would go out and play when they were, like, little, he would sit inside and play on the computer. And so he grew up in basically the time era that the internet was just breaking through.
Right.
And his dad also founded a software firm called the Mark Williams Company. So he kind of had that around to look at technology into. Okay, so his dad
was real technical.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
So he would play on the computer and try and figure out how the computer actually worked and, like, the way that websites were created and, like how things ran in the background of the computer, and he would, you know, want to take it apart and put it back together. And
so, like, real big brain.
Yeah, he was real, real big brain.
Okay.
And so he was a fucking phenomenal person, period.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and he was constantly questioning literally everything around him. Like, if something didn't seem right, he would stop at nothing until he could figure out, you know, hey, this is a way to potentially fix this. I'm going to give it a go. And then, you know, he would put his ideas and opinions out there and he would find.
That's kind of like a compulsion.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. He was kind of OCD about these things.
All right.
And so he became very, very interested in, like, internet and coding and programming and just computers as a whole from a young age.
Right.
So much so that at age, like, 13, he created the website theinfo.org, a collaborative online library. And I don't know about you, but if you think of this at a standpoint of what you were doing when you were 13, like, you're not on your fucking computer creating a website.
You're playing with stuffed animals in your room, right? I was running around with my little neighborhood gang that we had and smoking half-smoked cigarettes with my parents at 13. That's what I was doing.
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know what you were doing, but yeah, no, I was running around the neighborhood with my friends.
No.
Being a little rascal.
Exactly. Yeah. And so he wasn't actually, from what I heard, he wasn't into trouble, period, during any of his life.
So he was a nerd.
Yeah, he was a huge nerd. He was a nerd and basically proud of it. And so,
I mean, you should be. You should own your nerd.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the kid was fucking insanely I don't know. It's extremely unfortunate the things that people go through when they try to bring good into a world that doesn't necessarily want it.
Yeah, we kind of see that a lot in some of our conspiracy stories.
For sure. But when he created that website at age 13, he won this Ars Digita Prize, and it's given to young people who create useful, educational, and collaborative non-commercial websites.
It's a pretty good prize.
Yeah, So they don't give it out to, like, literally every kid that creates website. Like, you have to do some shit with this website in order to get on this list. So, at age 14, he became a member of the working group that authorized the RSS 1.0 web syndication specification system, which in layman terms, it was an automated system for delivering information from frequently updated sources. So for us to get like our podcast on here,
right,
we had to have an RSS code.
Yeah. Okay.
And so we wouldn't have been able to do that if it wasn't for Aaron Swartz creating that.
Oh, shit.
All
right. Big Bang Man. I see you.
Exactly.
Thank you, Aaron Swartz.
Yeah. And so he knew basically before most, just studying the internet all of his life, that the internet had potential. It was way bigger than what anybody thought it was going to be. Like, there were a group of people that, you know, knew the internet was going to grow, and it wasn't something that was going to just die out. Whereas, like, the rest of the world, they thought it was something that was just, like, a fad, and then people were going to get done with it because they didn't want to just sit there all day.
Yeah,
but guess what?
Instead, we all sit
guess
there and
what?
Like,
yeah. You can learn so much and get
right.
so much just from the internet.
Yeah, in our hands, we have our smartphone.
Exactly.
Or our computer. Like, we have that. We could find anything in the world that we want to know.
Yeah.
That's crazy. Like, when you really start to think about it, that's kind of crazy.
Yeah.
And people didn't think that was going to last.
Yeah. Like, they literally laughed at his face when he was like, yeah, you know, this is something that, you know, I'm going to really deeply get into. And they were like, you're not really going to go far with it. You're a kid. And then, you know, they were wrong. And what's crazy too is even at 14, while Aaron was working on the RSS coding for this, the group that he was talking to were all adults. They were all adults in colleges and tech, like, they've already done their shit. They were, you know, way older than him. And, you know, he went onto their site in a forum and started putting his opinion in. And so they're taking his opinions and, well, they're like, oh yeah, we want to, you know, hear this person out. They've got some good ideas. And then they fly this dude out, and it's a 14-year-old kid. And they were all like, what the fuck?
Well, I bet
that
didn't...
he started talking, and he came across like he was 50 years old.
I bet that
and had
probably
been doing all this
didn't
for
make
all
them
his
feel
life.
Very good.
No, it blew their minds.
Yeah.
Like, they gained so much respect for this kid.
That's crazy.
They treated him as an adult.
Okay.
And as one of them.
Okay, that's good then.
Yeah, yeah. They didn't see it as like, oh, well, this, you know, this is going to discredit me. Like, no,
okay.
This is somebody that was part of their team that helped them better.
Okay, cool. Oh,
yeah,
gotcha.
It wasn't like a, you know, fuck this kid.
Okay.
No. This kid was good on all levels. That's... There's, like, literally nobody, from what I heard, hated him. So, he basically wanted to make the internet good for all people and good and open and free-for-all.
Okay.
And he saw information, in fact, as something that was, as it should be, just free knowledge to all.
Right. That should be.
So, yeah. I mean...
We pay for fucking school, and they don't even teach us everything right.
No. Not even. No.
I don't use math in my daily life, contrary to what we were told in high school. I don't. Not really.
I do.
Not algebra. Not like what they were saying. Okay, I don't use geometry.
I had to use geometry to do our man conversion.
Okay. I'm not really pretty. Maybe
sucked.
I'm just dumb. Because it took me, what, 3 times to pass algebra 1 because I don't have big brain when it comes to math. This guy could probably run circles around me.
Probably. But he attended North Shore Country Day School, which was a small private school, until about 9th grade. And then in 9th grade, he left high school. And then in 10th grade, he enrolled in courses at Lake Forest College, which is basically like a private liberal arts school.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
And a sophomore.
Yeah.
Lee
yeah.
As a sophomore.
And so after that, he went to Stanford.
Okay.
And only stayed for a year because he just really didn't really vibe with the people and didn't feel like it was worth his time.
But really? He went to Stanford.
He went to Stanford and was just like, ah, fuck it. It's not for me.
I wish I had that luxury.
Like, these people were too stupid for me.
Oh, okay.
And so, during his time at Stanford, he applied to Y Combinator Summer Founders Program. And he proposed to work on a startup called Infogami, which was basically Wikipedia before Wikipedia was even a thing.
Okay.
And so later on that year, he would leave Stanford to create what we know as Reddit. And if you don't know what Reddit is, it's a social discussion website where members can, like, submit content or, like links and text posts and pictures, and you can vote on it and comment on it and share your opinions.
I didn't know that he was a part of a creation of Reddit.
Like, yeah, yeah.
I use Reddit on, like, the daily.
Yeah.
Because like, I'm real big into, like, conspiracies, and that's where I get my tea on Jim Dawson, because I don't want to watch his videos to give him any more money. So yeah. I just get my tea on Reddit about what people have to say about him. Good days. Good times.
But, yeah, he made, he helped make that a thing. And so he was basically, like, loaded from that. And he made that when he was, like, 19. Yeah. So.
What were you doing at 19?
Yeah, not that.
Getting blackout
drunk at Wendy's. Yep. Killing brain cells.
Killing brain cells, not gaining them, yeah.
So. He, what was I saying? Oh, he made Reddit, and then after he made Reddit, he left Stanford, and he wanted to go more out into the world of activism.
Okay.
Because at this time in the world, they were trying to pass a bill called the Online Piracy Act.
Right.
Yeah, that was it. And so basically this bill was gonna take all the information that anybody put out there for free. And if you had information and somebody didn't want to pay for it, you could go to prison and they could seize your stuff and take down your whole website, or that entire web page, or that entire category as a whole from the internet as a whole.
That is insane.
Yeah. And so they were trying to pass this bill at that time. So with him being wired in his brain the way that he was,
right,
that knowledge is something that we all deserve to have.
Yeah, that's
freely
kind of like basic human.
Yeah,
that
I mean,
should be a basic
before
human,
the
right?
Fucking internet, you know. Fucking Joseph didn't call Bill and was like, oh yeah, by the way, you know, I told you yesterday how to fix that drain pipe, so you now owe me $5 for that.
Right, right, we never had,
like,
yeah.
No, you could go fuck yourself, Bill, thanks, but that's free information, I don't have to pay you
right.
anything.
That would be like me telling you about anything in the world, and be like, hey, Britt, you owe me
$20. Yeah, us right now, talking.
Yeah, right, right,
yeah.
Right.
It's just like, no. So, he was trying to stop ridiculous shit like that. So, sadly, that's what got him in, like, a lot of deep shit.
Mm.
So, in 2008, he founded Watchdog.net, and it was called, quote-unquote, the good government site with teeth. And it was made to accumulate and visualize data about politicians. Which, obviously, like, politicians aren't going to like that.
Yeah,
So, Aaron's biggest worry, though, was that we, as a whole, would be deprived of information.
Okay.
So that same year, he wrote a widely circulated guerrilla open access manifesto. And at this time, he focused on civic awareness and activism And in 2009, Aaron helped launch the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, and he wanted to learn more on effective online activism so that he could potentially do more for the world and kind of, you know, help bring other people to kind of see this light happening.
Yeah.
And so he, in 2010, founded the online group Demand Progress, which was most known for its campaign against Stop Online Piracy Act, which was a bill that would, you know, take down, block, you know, the pages from the internet that were violating its codes and all that. And they would be blocked and taken down and investigated. And not only that, but the government and everybody would be able to control what we saw and posted in our lives more. Which, like, granted, that's, you know, already kind of, yeah, we're already out of there. So, yeah. And in 2011, Swartz was arrested by MIT police on state breaking and entering charges after he connected this computer to the MIT network in, like, it was a closet. And he downloaded academic journal articles systematically from JSTOR. And JSTOR was this basically online library where you could get articles that would kind of help you out. It was from other people's research and stuff, so you would have to pay for it. But he was against paying for it. So there's actually a interview that I want to show after this, where they go a little bit deeper into it, that the director of the Internet's Own Boy did with Bias. But they said that that he basically didn't use any of the journals that he stole at all. Like, he didn't use them for bad. He just had them. Like, that's literally, he was just using them to say, you know, hey, this is, you know, information that I need, so I'm going to take it. Yes.
Gotcha.
That's basically what he was saying. That's all that he did wrong, though. And so he was arrested for that. And in the documentary, they said JSTOR dropped the charges against Aaron. So, like, why the case went forward, I don't know.
And weird.
That's why this case is fucking crazy, because it shouldn't be a case to begin with at all. It should have been dropped.
Yeah, if they drop the charges, they really don't have a case to build on.
And so, federal prosecutors charged him with two counts of the Computer Fraud and Abuse Act, carrying a cumulative max penalty of $1 million in fines, 35 years in prison, asset forfeiture, restitution, and supervised release. So they did all this to a kid
who just
took some articles from the internet without paying him. Now, granted, he did ask JSTOR how much it would be to buy all of the articles from JSTOR. Or I think he also tried to buy JSTOR itself so that he could, you know, get information out there for people for free. But I don't think anything happened with that. But but either way, they dropped the charges, and somehow the defense lawyer or something was able to get the prosecutor was able to push it into federal courts and get 13 more charges put on it on top of the other four. Yeah. Which I can't, I'll have to look it up again, because I can't remember what all these charges were,
But, it's kind of like a bunch of bullshit charges. Yeah, an additional 13 charges?
Yeah, and it was enough to make it a federal case, is what they were trying to do, which was,
like they were just gunning for him.
Yeah, I mean, like, they saw him, they saw an opportunity to make a name, because at this time, activism was a huge thing, especially with the internet being in as much trouble as it was at that point.
So they were like, oh, so, we got this one dude, we can take him down.
Yeah, yeah.
Show an example to everybody else. Yeah. That's crazy.
So they basically took all of his money. His parents were struggling with money, trying to help him with this. His relationships were having issues. Like, him and his ex broke up because of it. And then he got into a new relationship. And that relationship was hard to maintain because he was stressed all the time.
Right.
Depressed all the time. He didn't really have a life anymore. And it was just, they were milking him for everything he was worth just to put his head on a stake.
It's fucked up.
So, they upped his charges after Aaron declined a plea deal. And he declined the plea deal because he was like, I haven't done anything wrong.
Right. I mean, yeah, he did.
He admitted that he did that wrong, but the other
things he didn't do,
charges
right.
that they pressed against him, he knew that all of those were wrong.
Right.
So, on September 12, 2012, federal prosecutors added 9 more counts to his 4 counts, which increased his time in prison to 50 years of imprisonment and $1 million in fines. They overcharged him for alleged computer crimes. So they said that he allegedly could have committed these crimes because they didn't know why he was taking the documents.
What?
Yeah. And so
what?
Swartz then went back to his apartment and hung himself on January 11th, 2013. And my eyes, like, basically the U.S. government killed this kid for saying, hey, you know, I don't think it's right that we have to pay for shit online that's information-based.
What the fuck?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, they were trying to put him in prison for the rest of his life for taking articles. Okay, that's the same shit that we do on Wikipedia on a daily.
Right.
So, what is the big issue with this kid going on this website and getting articles there? Okay, and not only that, but him and JSTOR, from what I read, they settled it and dropped it, and he gave the articles back to JSTOR. He didn't even keep them.
That's crazy because I think, like, we use.
And he had.
We get on Google and we build a case.
Yeah.
Using the information that we got from his website.
Exactly.
And he got prosecuted for it. I mean, I could see where they would punish him for a potential. He pretty much hacked it and stole information.
Yes.
Yes. They could have punished him for that. But even then, that's not even.
No.
A federal crime.
No.
If it was breaking into the FBI.
Yeah, no, that would have been, yeah, that would have been completely different.
But
he didn't do this. And so nothing in this case, they literally just took a kid and milked him for all of his money, success, and work.
They were trying to show everybody, hey, if you break the law, this is what's going to happen. If you stand up for what you believe in, this is what's going to happen.
Basically. So, you know, they were basically saying, hey, don't speak up against the shit that we're for, because if you got a problem with it, we have a problem with you. If we have a problem with you, you're going to end up fucking dead. Exactly.
Just a conspiracy, guys.
Yes.
That one's just a conspiracy. Just saying.
Cough, cough. But right now, I'm going to play the clip for you guys from Vice Meets, and it's the interview with the creator, Brian Knappenberger, the creator of the internet's own boy on Aaron Swartz.
He's throwing himself into a ton of stuff, into working through the process. But when he confronted JSTOR and the fact that, you know, here is a database that charges people enormous amounts of money to access information, it seems like it offended him in a very visceral way. Absolutely. So what is JSTOR?
JSTOR is a kind of repository of academic journal articles. It has a whole history. It's one of many people in this field, many companies, corporations in this field, that basically takes what is sometimes a taxpayer-funded research and gets the copyright from the the researcher or the institution that created it, and then and houses it on this kind of online database in which you then go and pay more for this.
So literally, research that is funded by taxpayers is not research that I can access for free.
Right.
Got it.
That's the contention. That's the problem. That's the heart of the problem.
And my understanding is that, you know, this research, the idea is that it's supposed to propagate. It's supposed to spread. You know, people are supposed to learn from it. Other researchers are supposed to be able to, you know, build on that research.
Yeah.
That's the whole idea, right?
Right, right. Well, right. So you go, if you go to JSTOR, these things cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
I mean, 50, 60, 70 bucks for a single article.
For a single article.
Yeah. Yeah.
But if you want to access, you know, the whole universe, I mean, that's going to be quite a bit more expensive.
It's almost impossible. And also, so the original researchers don't get any of that money, right? And they want their work to be, I mean, if you're a researcher, you want your work to be disseminated as widely as possible. You want it to be cited in other people's journals. That's how, you know.
But JSTOR will say, well, actually, we need money to run this whole system.
Right,
right.
Right. And I think that was probably true in the very early days, in the 90s, right, that they needed that. But at this point, it's the amount of, and this is true with all of these, and not just JSTOR is not actually the worst offender here, but that's the argument that they needed in order to run the database. But their operating costs are so low compared to the amount of money that they make. And, I mean, they're making.
Like, so was this something that Aaron money. Was just... Was this something he talked to his friends about? Was this something that just really pissed him off?
Yeah, I mean, I think one time there's a story that we recount in the film where he was at a conference in Europe and he asked somebody from JSTOR how much would it take to buy all the articles and release them online for free. And the answer was something like $200 million. And he just thought that was outrageous. He thought that was absolutely outrageous. So
Aaron was literally thinking about, well, gosh, is there some solution where I can work with JSTOR?
Yeah.
And just,
yeah. Yeah.
So tell us exactly what he stands, what he was accused of doing, what he did.
Yeah. So essentially what he was accused of doing was downloading 4.7 million academic journal articles from JSTOR.
And how did he do that?
And so he did it through the MIT network, which is an open, famously kind of open, famously fast network in which you could go, you don't have to be an MIT student, you can just go on the campus and access it. MIT has access to JSTOR, right? So through that connection, that fast connection and clear access, he downloaded 4.7 million academic journal articles, right?
How much time did it take?
It a period of over a few months.
So he was just very systematically
himself. Exactly.
Going day in, day out, just doing that.
Yeah. Well, not every day, but it's alleged that it was multiple times over maybe a month and a half period.
Yeah. This is a busy guy. This is not a guy who was just, you know, so he took this seriously.
Yeah, he took it very seriously. And he wrote a script that said, keep grabbing .py, which basically just grabbed one article, took it down, and stored it, and then just grabbed the next article. It's a lot of these kind of hacking cases fit this similar kind of script crawler mode where when they're scraping a database, it's just one, the number at the end of the article just is increased every single time. So it's relatively easy to write a script that some of these things come prepackaged. It's not even writing it from scratch.
So to your Thoreau quote, I mean, it's just, you know, he decided that JSTOR, it was just so outrageous that we don't know what he was planning on doing about it, but he decided to do something.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this is what's puzzling. And I think it does speak to that sort of question that an activist might have as to where to transgress the law or to work within the system. And this is where that Thoreau quote, I think, becomes particularly kind of sharp. What do you do when you're confronted with something that you see as an unjust law? And so he was in possession of 4.7 million journal articles when he was arrested. He didn't dump them, right? He didn't do anything with them as far as it was just on a hard drive. And
this was not a mountain of cocaine on right. the back of a forklift.
That's yeah. right. Right.
It's 4.7 million journal articles right. on a hard drive.
And it's actually very difficult to understand, well, okay, for the prosecutors, what are we going to prosecute here? They identified that he was on the network several different times, and they kicked him off, and he ratted around it. And they ultimately figured out that he had accessed, in one of these kind of workarounds, he actually entered an MIT closet and plugged a computer in that was downloading his articles directly, not from the Wi-Fi or anything, just directly from the servers. And they found out he was in there, and they bugged it, and they put a surveillance camera in there, and they basically created a sting operation of sorts. I mean, and they didn't stop the downloading, right? Which is a significant fact. Like, they didn't say, this is dangerous. They realized they wanted to catch the person. They wanted to catch him coming back. So they let the downloading continue.
Did they know who it was? At that point, when they decided to bug the closet, I mean, did they have a sense of who it was?
I don't have evidence that they knew it was him. I don't know. I'm not sure. They knew this person was being persistent. And so they set up this sting operation. And then once they had him on camera, they sent the police after him. Cambridge police went after him, chased him down, threw him on the ground, arrested him.
And this is a guy who was a young guy, physically slight, not a guy who was, he was a guy who was intellectually aggressive and combative, but he was not a guy who was used to being
physical to that.
Thrown on the ground by the cops.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, he was on his bike, and they chased him down, and they threw him on the ground. His father said that Aaron had told him that he wasn't aware that these were police, didn't know what was going on, apparently undercover. So they put him in solitary. There's a point where he put him in solitary confinement, where they, they didn't know what was going on for a long time. I think they were trying to intimidate him a little bit. So that's essentially how he was arrested.
So you studied hackers closely in your previous film, and this is a world that you know very well. And so this was MIT. Aaron Swartz was a very well known figure. There were lots of different ways this case could have been handled.
Yeah.
How was it handled?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you think about MIT's role, it's very puzzling. It's certainly puzzling to anybody who has dealt with MIT in any real way. Certainly a lot of alumni and students and faculty were really puzzled by MIT's role in this. I mean, MIT traditionally has encouraged kind of pushing the boundaries a little bit, especially technological boundaries, encouraged a little transgression in order to sort of come up with new ideas. I mean, it's kind of at the core of who they are. And so what they did in this case is that they took what they called a neutral position, right? In other words, this is their take on it. They say, we're not going to do anything here. We're going to try to, we're not going to come down on anybody's side. We're just going to play have this kind of neutral stance, which was problematic. Because first of all, they missed a really good opportunity to be a leader, to say, what is this activity? What did he do? Is this really bad? And how bad is it? Right? The prosecutor's office put a press release out that said 35 years in prison and a $1 million fine. It was a 4-count indictment that later was increased to 13 counts, 13 felonies, and they seemed very intent on getting him for a felony. Making a felon out of it. So MIT missed a huge opportunity for
Could
some
MIT
sort of clarity.
Prevented that from happening? Could MIT have intervened with the prosecutors?
It's hard to know, but there's certainly what's interesting is JSTOR, who's technically the victim of the case in this so-called crime, backed out. And the Aaron's lawyer at the time said, "Look, it wasn't friendly. They weren't our friends, but they realized pretty soon that they hadn't." No real damage had happened to them.
Well, that was heavy.
Yeah, but that was the clip. You guys give us your opinions on it. He kind of explained things and was able to...
He added in a little bit more detail.
Yeah, a little bit more detail.
Just a little bit, yeah.
So go check out his documentary, The Internet's Own Boy. It's really, really good. It'll tell you guys a lot more than I could. But as far as things go, we are out.
All right, and we will be with you guys tomorrow night for another episode, actually. So stay tuned for that.